Everybody. I was thinking as I was getting ready to begin that the program seems to be running overtime, and it's officially scheduled to end at 12:15, that we know that there's a famous kasha that everybody asks as to why is it that Hanukkah is celebrated for 8 days when the miracle of Hanukkah was only 7 days, because there was enough pure olive oil to last for one day of Hanukkah. And the miracle was that it lasted an additional 7 days. So there are so many different discussions that are preoccupied with this question, and it's even a sefer called Ner LeMeir with 100 different answers to this kasha. But you almost never hear anybody asking the question, why is Hanukkah only 8 days? It should really be 9 days, because after all, we add an extra day for every other holiday because we're not really sure when it's supposed to begin. So I realized that the reason must be because people are always interested in making things shorter and not longer. So on that basis, even though the program seems to be running a little bit late, I will still try to finish at the appropriate time at approximately 12:15. And then maybe I'll give time for questions, and those who want to stay and ask questions can do so. So I'll begin with some Milei D'Agadata. There's a comment of the B'nai Yisaskar, who's a very famous Hasidic Rebbe, who wrote a sefer in which he spoke about all the different holidays of the year, including many, many pages, that he has beautiful insights in Divrei Torah about Hanukkah. So he quotes a medrash that the Avadim had an expression that they said to the Jews at the time, the Chashmonaim, they said, Kisru lachem al keren ashur, you should write on the horn of the ox of the shore, Elochem Chelek of Elokei Yisrael. You have no portion of the God of Israel. They wanted to assimilate everybody. They wanted to Hellenize everybody. So therefore, they wanted them to write this statement. So the B'nai Yisaskar asks, what's the significance of the Keren Ashur, with the horn of the ox? So he explains that the paradigm for how to intersect successfully with secular society, with secular culture, is none other than Yosef HaTzadik, whom we read about in the Parshios HaShavua right now. He went down to Mitzrayim, he became a successful business person, he was able to avoid the temptations of sin, he was able to avoid the possible dangers of assimilation, he became the viceroy of the entire country, and still maintained his Torah values and his Torah perspective, never lost sight of the Demus Yukino, of the image and the teachings of his father Yaakov when he grew up under his wings. So the B'nai Yisaskar explains that Yosef is described in the Torah as Bechor Shoro, Adar Lo. He's described as the ox. So when the Yavanim said the expression, Kisvu lechem keren ashur, that you should write on the horn of the ox, that you don't have a chelek, it means that you're also part of a secular society. But tell Yosef that when you become part of a secular society, the right approach is not to maintain your own Torah individualism, but rather the right approach is to assimilate entirely into secular culture. So this is what the Chashmonaim had to fight against. And we know that the three different mitzvot that the Yavanim wanted to abolish, that were the most prominent in their agenda, were Bris Milah, right, and Shabbos, and Rosh Chodesh. That's why the B'nai Yisaskar says that it says with respect to Yosef HaTzadik that he counteracted all of that, because says the Chimesh, the Eretz Mitzrayim, the Sheva Shnei HaSavah, that he provided for the right resources and ammunition. That's the Lashon of the Chimesh. So the B'nai Yisaskar says the Chimesh is Osios Chodesh, Milah, and Shabbos. That he made sure to preserve all of those values. And that's the example that we're all supposed to follow as well. So the question is, we understand that Shabbos is very integral to religion. It's the centerpiece of the Jewish religion is the observance of Shabbos. We understand Bris Milah, that throughout all the centuries, people used to always sacrifice their lives in order to be able to maintain the mitzvah. Even in recent times, when people in the Soviet gulags would circumcise themselves because, as the Gemara says, there was always tremendous Mesivas Nefesh. People always gave up themselves and risked their lives in order to preserve the mitzvah of circumcision. But why is there such a hoopla about the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh? So I think that relates directly to our discussion of today, that Rosh Chodesh stands for, as the Sforno says, on the mitzvah of HaChodesh HaZeh L'Fem Rosh Chodeshir, when we were given the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, the Sforno says, Vasos Behem Ketzonchem, that the whole idea of Rosh Chodesh is that you're given mastery over time. When we were slaves in Egypt, we didn't have mastery over our own time, over our own destiny. The idea of being having the ability to establish when it's Rosh Chodesh, when it's the beginning of a month, what seasons are significant to us, how we order our day, how we order our lives, that is what Rosh Chodesh is all about. That is why Rosh Chodesh is so incredibly integral to our tradition, because it stands for the proposition that we are in control of our destinies, we order our lives, we order our dealings, in accordance with the Torah values and not in accordance with the values of the surrounding secular society. And this is very prominently the theme of the discussion of what do we do when we find that our own system of law comes into conflict with the secular system of laws. So what do we do when there is a conflict between Torah law and with secular law? How do we live within a society that has a separate system of laws while at the same time preserving the integrity of the Torah system of law? So here we have to distinguish between the different domains in terms of understanding how we navigate this tension, how we navigate this intersection. So the first domain that I wanted to focus upon, if you look in your materials, is the domain of Dina de Malchusa Dina. We know that there is a principle in Torah law which actually allows for a certain amount of integration or accommodation of secular law. And that is in the domain of Dina de Malchusa Dina, which literally means the law of the land is the law. And that is the statement of Shmuel in Bava Kamma and a number of places. And the Gemara says that the Teda, the Kutli Dikli, the Kashi Gishri, the Rabbinin Alayu, that the government of any particular country has the ability to cut down trees, to exercise eminent domain, to make highways, to build bridges. And we utilize all of their resources. So since we utilize all of their resources, therefore, they have the right to impose certain laws upon us, since we're benefiting from their land, to impose certain taxes upon us, and that becomes incorporated into our legal system as well, into the Torah law, through the Torah principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. However, there is a very strong cautionary note which is sounded by the Rashba, one of the great Rishonim. And the Rashba said that even though there certainly is a domain in which there are laws, such as the Rashbam points out in source number two, taxes and laws of that sort that become incorporated into our way of life by virtue of our living in a particular government and taking advantage of their services, nonetheless, that is not meant to imply in any way, shape, or form that this serves as a replacement to supplant our Torah system of law. And the Rashba says this very, very strongly. He was talking about a situation involving Yerusha, involving an inheritance. What happened? There was a custom in certain parts where if a woman and a man got married, and the wife passed away within the first year or so of marriage, according to Torah law, the inheritance of the wife goes to the husband. But there was a custom that since the wife brought in much into the marriage with the expectation, the father of the wife had given a tremendous dowry with the expectation the marriage would last for a long time, He did not intend to invest his money in the marriage if it would be very short-lasting. So if it would end up being short-lasting, then there was an understanding that the money would revert to the father of the bride who had given the generous dowry, rather than going to the husband who would otherwise inherit the wife according to Torah law. And the question was posed to the Rashba that in a particular case where this had not been the explicit understanding of the parties when they got married that the money should go back to the father, she would just automatically say that the money should go back to the father because of the fact that this was the secular law that prevailed in the country where they lived. That the money would always go back to the father. And the Rashba says very, very strongly that when it comes to these types of laws, like the laws of inheritance within the Jewish community, it was absolutely unconscionable to work with the assumption that we're going to uproot the laws of the Torah and replace them with the laws of secular society. And if you look at the fifth line of the quotation from the Rashba, he says, "V'nomar ken bavla Yerushas b'no Abchor." If you say this, you're going to invalidate and you're going to obliterate the laws of Yerusha, the laws of inheritance, like those that would go to the inheritance of a Bechor, of an eldest born son, to call an Akalos, the Tira Shabbasim Abanim, and you would equate the Yerusha of daughters with sons, Bechlau Oker Koldine Atara Ashlema, and you would uproot all of the laws of our holy and complete Torah. And what then would be the purpose of all of the holy svarim, Shechivu Lanu Rebbe, that were authored by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the Achara, Rabbinim, Rabashi, and those who composed and compiled the Gemara, Yomduas, B'neim, Dinei Agoyim? We may as well just teach our children all the secular laws and not send them to yeshiva altogether. And they would just build altars to worship at the secular laws of their society. Chalila, God forbid, lo tiyeh kazos b'Yisrael, such a thing should not exist within the Jewish nation. Chas v'shalom shematakla ha-Torah aleh asah. If such a thing would be done, then the Torah would have to wear sackcloth and ashes and be in mourning over the fact that it had been nullified in favor of secular law. So the Rashba says very clearly that even though there is some sort of principle of Dina de Malchus Adina, that is not intended in any way to eradicate the viability of the laws of the Torah. It is confined to a very specific and limited domain. And then the question is, how do you understand the contours of that circumscribed domain where secular law does become relevant and operative in a Torah society? So that is fleshed out further in the next couple of sources. It's fleshed out, first of all, and perhaps most importantly, by the Tashbeit, and then fleshed out a little bit further by Rav Moshe Feinstein in a responsum that he wrote about the subject. So if you look at the Tashbeit articulates perhaps the most important distinction in the domain of Dina de Malchus Adina. And what the Tashbeit says is as follows. Says, Afilu, Shafilu Tim Salomar, even if you say that you're going to have some sort of broad application of the principle of the Dina de Malchus Adina, then that it would be applicable to various monetary laws. Nonetheless, it is absolutely impossible and it is absolutely prohibited to apply this principle. We cannot say this with respect to everything. The milsa pshitah, that it is something which is beyond simple. That whenever it comes to ritual matters, This principle of dina de ma'usa dina was never applicable. What does that mean? It means that when it comes to ritual matters, when it comes to matters of ritual prohibition, such as the obligation to keep Shabbos, such as the obligation to eat kosher, such as any other obligation which involves absolute ritual obligations of the Torah, or staying away from the commission of ritual prohibitions in the Torah, then it does not matter what the law of the land is. If the law of the land says that you have to violate Shabbos, we're obligated to keep Shabbos anyway. If the law of the land is that we're not allowed to eat kosher, we're obligated to eat kosher anyway. Whenever there is a law of the land that would run afoul of our ritual obligations, then there is absolutely no relevance. That would be an area, if there was a conflict between the Torah law and between the secular law, we are duty bound to resolve that tension by preferring the Torah law. Not only that, but if there is a ritual prohibition involved, the law is that one is obligated to give up all of their money rather than to transgress a ritual prohibition. And if one is obligated to give up all of their money, they certainly are obligated to violate the law if the law would run in contradiction to what would be Torah obligations. Now, for the most part, in American society, this does not usually present a problem because of the fact that there's one of the great distinctions of this society is that, unlike the Yavanim, who are interested in stamping out Rosh Chodesh and Bris Milah and Shabbos and Kol HaTorah Kula in order to advance their own Hellenistic religion, when it comes to the way that this country was set up, it was established with a constitutional right to its free exercise of religion. The notion of free exercise of religion stands, presumably, for exactly this proposition, that the government will not trample upon the rights of individuals to exercise their own religious practices when it comes to the realm of their ritual observance of their religion. This is what, for the most part, is a protective zone within this country. Nonetheless, there sometimes can arise areas where there could be a potential tension, even within the constitutional framework that was established by this country. So, for example, about 10 years ago, there was a famous court case in the state of New York where there were a couple of rabbis who were involved in marriage counseling. And in the course of performing their marriage counseling, they found out certain information from the wife, and they're speaking to the wife, which they felt created a duty of disclosure on their part, both to the court and to the husband, in order to prevent what they viewed as religious harm. And they viewed their disclosure as a fulfillment of the principle of lo samon adam re'echa. They are not allowed to stand idly by your fellow's blood. And this is understood by the commentators as meaning that there is an affirmative religious obligation to save somebody from physical harm, that there is an affirmative obligation, as the Rambam understands and others, to save somebody from monetary harm, and as the Minchas Chinuch and others understand, that there's also an affirmative obligation to save somebody from spiritual harm. And in this particular case, they understood that the individuals involved in this case were in potential of spiritual harm. They felt that Based on what they had learned, there was information the husband needed to know, there was information that they needed to disclose for the benefit of the children involved in order to protect them from spiritual harm based on information that had been disclosed by the wife. So the wife promptly turned around and sued the rabbis in court for a tort violation of a breach of her confidentiality. Because there was a statute on the books in the state of New York saying that whenever there was a conversation between a clergy person and a congregant, that created a clergy penitent privilege. The conversations were privileged, and therefore the disclosure of that information would be a breach of the confidentiality. Since the confidentiality had been breached, the woman sued the rabbis for that violation and for the suffering that she felt that she had endured as a result of their breach. Now, it's possible that different rabbinic authorities may have construed the information that they received differently in terms of whether they felt that there really was a Jewish law obligation based on Lo Zama or Adam Riecha to disclose the information of the wife's conduct or whatever it was specifically. And maybe reasonable rabbinic minds could have differed, but the point is that based on their conscientious interpretation of Jewish law sources, they came to the obligation that they had a religious ritual obligation to divulge that information. And the first court, the lower court in the state of New York that heard this case, actually came to the conclusion that the rabbis could be held liable for their breach of confidentiality in that case based on the fact that there was a statute in the books in the state of New York that created this clergy penitent privilege. I remember at the time I was working at the Bezdin, and with a couple of other individuals we wrote an article about some of the tensions that this case presented. And if you look at source number 6 on page 2, basically what we wrote was in the event that the halakha mandates disclosure of information, then disclosure is obligatory even if it will result in an inevitable violation of secular law. Because this is the principle of the Tashbetz. If there really is a violation of the prohibition of Lo Samo and Adam Riecha, then one is not allowed to stand idly by their fellow's blood, then halakha does not recognize the applicability of Dina Demachus Dina, and then the rabbis or any other Jewish figure is placed in the very uncomfortable position of basically being forced by virtue of the secular law to violate the secular law because of their allegiance and necessary loyalty to halakhic principles. So the conclusion of the article was that the discomfort heaped upon rabbis due to the entanglement of secular law requirements with the dictates of halakha only serves to underscore the necessity for a more conscientious application of the free exercise clause of the U.S. Constitution by the secular courts. And this was not a judgment on the merits of the case before us necessarily. As I said, I'm sure reasonable rabbinic minds could differ. However, what this was meant to address was the concern that once there is legislation, even if it is well-meaning, that could infringe upon the free exercise of rabbis or other members of the Jewish faith in terms of the performance of their ritual obligations, this creates a real-life tension that could exist even in modern times, even in a country which is as unbelievably tolerant as the United States of America. You could still end up having to deal with these types of conflicts where you have to assess that the Torah says that in order to avoid violating a negative prohibition, one is obligated to give up all of their money. And there were discussions at the time that maybe that only applies if the negative commandment is violated actively, but if it's a negative commandment like lo sa'amod al dameyecha, standing idly by as one's brother's blood is being shed, which is only violated passively by standing and doing nothing, so maybe then there's a different threshold. Maybe then one only has to give up to 20% of their fortune rather than their entire fortune, according to certain commentators. But that creates almost an impossible situation for rabbis who would be thrust into that type of a dilemma where they would have to weigh what are the chances of my getting sued and would I likely lose up to 20% of my fortune. So that really wasn't a very good way to approach these types of situations. So what happened was that the Court of Appeals of the State of New York, which obviously read our article, came to the conclusion that in fact the ruling of the lower court was absolutely wrong, that it was an infringement upon the free exercise of religion. And therefore, what they said was, how do you justify the statute that says that there is a clergy penitent privilege which is attached to any conversation between a person and their clergyman, whether it's a priest, whether it's a rabbi, whomever it might be. So the court said this has to be understood as simply as an evidentiary rule, meaning that the secular court, then the secular government, has the right to define what they view for their court system to be acceptable evidence that would be presented in the court. And they have the right to say that any information that a person discloses in the context of a clergy penitent conversation, a conversation between, say, a person and the rabbi of their community, the courts and the statutes have the right to say that any information that is divulged in the course of that communication is privileged for evidentiary purposes and therefore cannot be used as evidence in a court case. But that is different than saying that you can actually go and sue a rabbi for disclosure of the information if he feels that he's obligated to disclose it according to Torah principles. That is beyond the pale of the court system. The rabbis have the right to exercise their religious obligation. People have the right not to talk to their rabbis if they're worried their rabbis will exercise their religious obligation. But that is not something which can be legislated by the courts because it would in fact be an infringement upon the free exercise of religion by the rabbis in that situation. In fact, it's interesting, there was a court case once in which a person had sort of divulged to a rabbi that he had murdered his wife, and then he was convicted of murder, and then he tried to overturn the conviction on the basis of the fact that the information the rabbi received was inadmissible as evidence because it was in the context of a clergy penitent conversation, but the court upheld the conviction because it held in that particular case based on the peculiarities of the context of that conversation, even though the person was speaking to a rabbi, they weren't speaking to the rabbi in his capacity as a spiritual advisor, and therefore that particular conversation was not privileged. But as a usual matter, this type of conversation would be viewed as privileged, but the right result, I believe, as we wrote in the article, is that it is improper to be able to bring a lawsuit against rabbis for exercising what they perceive to be their religious obligation. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in source number 5, basically says that it's not only a division between the religious sphere, the sphere of ritual obligations, and the monetary sphere, but even within the monetary sphere, as the Rashba had indicated, we're not interested, nor is it appropriate for us to eradicate our entire complex system of Torah law. And here at Yeshiva, what do you think we teach? We teach the students the intricacies of Shabbos law, but we also teach them the intricacies of Baba Kama and Baba Metziah and Baba Basra, in which we teach about tort liability from a Torah perspective. We teach about contracts and claims from a Torah perspective. We speak about partnership obligations and real estate obligations from a Torah perspective. We do have incredibly thorough and incredibly rich laws that describe every detail and every single piece of minutia of monetary dealings between individuals. So therefore, it's not appropriate to simply wipe them all out based on the principle of Dina de Machusa Dina. Rather, what does Dina de Machusa Dina really include? Asks Rav Moshe Feinstein. Says what it really includes are those types of monetary regulations that are so essential to the well-being of society that if anybody would privately go against them, then that would cut down the fabric of a well-regulated economic society. So if I have two people who enter into a partnership, they can of course conduct their partnership according to Torah principles. I have two neighbors who are settling a neighbor dispute. They can of course conduct that dispute in accordance with Torah principles. I have two people who get married. They can of course live their marriage in accordance with Torah principles. The government is perfectly content with any two individuals, any community of people conducting their affairs according to their religious tenets when it comes to their monetary dealings with each other. It's only with respect to more global types of issues where there's a specific enactment that has to be applied in a way which is universally consistent in order for the enactment to be effective, where we would apply the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. So specifically, Rav Moshe writes about a bankruptcy law proceeding. He says that I have, for example, a bankruptcy from an individual or a corporation, and bankruptcy law says that there's a certain order for how debts can be collected with whatever assets remain from the bankrupt individual or entity, that it says this type of creditor gets first, and this type of creditor gets second, and this type of creditor gets third. So you can't say that if Jewish law would permit to somebody to collect their debts, that creditor can just go to the bankruptcy debtor and collect all of their debts, and then subject everybody else to the secular law system, then you'll have a breakdown of the regulation of bankruptcy within society, and then the whole goal and purpose of the bankruptcy laws will be thwarted. So therefore, in that case, says Rav Moshe, in order to be able to preserve the regime of order, of economic order that was created by the government, everybody has to comply, and that's where Dina de Machusa Dina would become applicable. Or other posts can say, in the context of, say, rent control laws, where there are laws for the betterment of society, where you can't have an individual tenant who says, even though I'm entitled to the protection, it's okay, you can terminate my lease, because even if the two people agree between themselves, that would break down the entire economic purpose of creating this type of a safety hatch for people, of having rent control regulations in order to protect some of the more vulnerable members of society. So that's also something that many folks can say. You can't contract around, and you can't say that Jewish law will be applicable in a specific case, because there's a more global type of societal issue that would be implicated. However, in the majority of monetary dealings, we would generally say that the default proposition is that Torah law is what regulates people's conduct. Even in such cases, if Dina de Machusa Dina is not applicable, and you have, for example, a husband and a wife who unfortunately are getting divorced, and they want to say that in an individual case, and they want their divorce to be governed by the prevailing norms of surrounding societies, so that if they live in New York, the assets will be divided according to equitable distribution law and not according to Torah law, they have the right to make that contractual stipulation between themselves. However, they don't have a mandate to do so based on Dina de Malchus Adina. Since it's a monetary law, and monetary law does allow for private contracting of individual parties, just like the Gemara says, that if I am watching somebody's property and I'm not getting I'm not getting paid for it, so that I'm not liable if it gets stolen. But I can say to you that even though I'm a shomer chinam and I'm not liable if it gets stolen, I take upon myself the obligations of a shomer sofer, of somebody who is getting paid and would be liable if it gets stolen. I have the right to make that contractual arrangement between you and me. But we're not going to impose that regime upon anybody, and we're not going to impose a secular law regime upon anybody. If there's a case that appears in Besdin, then it would depend upon whether parties had contracted to follow some other type of monetary system. If they have decided they're going to follow the laws of secular society, they can do so, but we're not going to impose it upon them even in a monetary sphere. The difference between the monetary sphere and the ritual sphere is that in the ritual sphere, even if parties contract between each other, that they're going to agree that they're going to follow secular law and not observe the Torah ritual prohibitions, they don't have the right to do so. If two parties appear before Besdin and they say that we made a contract that we're going to operate our business on Shabbos, they don't have the right to operate their business on Shabbos. But for the most part, in this country at least, what is certainly a much bigger improvement over what used to exist in prior times is that we very rarely have these types of tensions. For the most part, we do have the ability, and therefore we should take pride in our prerogative and to be able to live our lives completely according to Torah law, both in the ritual sphere and in the secular sphere. That's why I believe it's one of the greatest manifestations of Kiddush Hashem, really sanctifying God's name in recent times, that we've had a revitalization of the whole system of Beis Din, of having Jewish courts and people come before Jewish courts, where we have the ability to actually resolve disputes and adjudicate monetary cases as well, in accordance with principles of Torah financial law, which are incredibly developed and incredibly thorough in terms of their addressing really every single type of monetary dispute that could conceivably arise. Now, the flip side of the question that I wanted to address briefly, and I'll do this just in a couple of minutes and then take the questions, is what about the other side? What about when secular law is enacting its particular statutes? To what degree is there a relevance of Torah law? So obviously we don't control secular society. What's interesting is that we've always seen a benefit of utilizing the secular law and the secular courts when they have been able to further Torah principles. So for example, the Gemara in Gittin says that if a Beis Din makes a ruling that a husband is obligated to give his wife a get, it's perfectly appropriate to utilize the secular court system so that the secular court system will enforce the Beis Din's judgments. And the secular court will say, Aseh mashi Yisrael omim l'chol lasos, do what the Jewish courts and the Jewish rabbis are requiring you to do. It is appropriate for us to work in a symbiotic fashion with the secular court system in order to further Torah principles. What's also, and that is a good justification for the get law, in fact, which get law number one, I'm not going to get into get law number two, we don't have enough time. New York State has two get laws, but get law number one basically says that a man is who files for divorce is not entitled to receive his civil divorce until he first gives his wife a get. This is perfectly permissible in Jewish law because saying to somebody that we're going to withhold a benefit from you until you do a get is considered to be a valid get according to Jewish law. A get has to be voluntary. It can't be coerced in order to be valid. However, it's only coerced if we impose a penalty on somebody and say that we're only going to take away the penalty if you give your wife a get. That could be a coerced get. But if we say we're going to withhold a benefit from you unless you give a get, so that's generally fine. So Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled that saying to somebody we're going to withhold a civil divorce, there's no intrinsic right, according to Jewish law, to have a civil divorce. That's not, you know, within the fundamental rights of Judaism. We've got to withhold a civil divorce from you until you give your wife a get is perfectly permissible. So that legislation was encouraged by the rabbinic community, and that exists on the books in New York today. A man who files for divorce can't get his civil divorce until he first takes care of the get. That's a way of utilizing the secular court system in appropriate measure in order to be able to further Torah objectives. But what about when the secular society is promulgating its own rules? You know, this came up in the context of the famous court case, the famous Supreme Court case of Roe v. Wade. How many of you are familiar with Roe v. Wade? It's a pretty famous case. Like, if there was one Supreme Court case in the afternoon, when people said, okay, you know, I'm going to test how smart you are, can you name me a Supreme Court? That's probably the most likely case that anybody would name, is Roe v. Wade. So Roe v. Wade was a case in the 1970s that involved abortion, and the question was, to what degree was it permissible or not permissible constitutionally for states to regulate abortion on the part of women? To what degree were they required to allow women to have abortions, and to what degree did they have a right to regulate abortion? It's interesting, the Supreme Court justice who authored the decision of Roe v. Wade was Harry Blackmun. Harry Blackmun was the Supreme Court justice whom one of my professors, when I was at Yale Law School, clerked for Justice Blackmun, and he was still a justice when I was a student, and there was one time that she took the entire class to meet him in the Supreme Court, and I have a very nice picture in my office with myself standing right next to Harry Blackmun, and we're both smiling and flanking each other, and it's, you know, I invite you to take a look at the photograph, but I didn't end up clerking for him. But anyway, in the course of his decision, he actually took into account the different sensibilities of the religious community within the United States in terms of arriving at a definition of what constitutes the beginning of life. Problem is, once you're trying to figure out a definitive approach from Jewish law authorities, that becomes a very thorny exercise, because you have to navigate through usually a tremendous multiplicity of different opinions. What he wrote in the Roe v. Wade case at source number 10 is, it should be sufficient to know briefly the wide divergence of thinking on this most sensitive and difficult question. There has always been strong support for the view that life does not begin until live birth. This was the belief of the Stoics. It appears to be the predominant, though not the unanimous, attitude of the Jewish faith. Based on his reading of the Jewish law sources, that was his conclusion, that most of the authorities thought that life begins at birth. Of course, as we know, there's a very complex literature about abortion. You know, abortion is prohibited according to Jewish law, and under what circumstances and at what point of the pregnancy could it be permitted. Of course, there are many different opinions amongst the authorities, but the point is that both in this case and in other Supreme Court cases as well, what was viewed as relevant from even a secular law constitutional perspective was to take into account the religious sensibilities of the populations that constitute the people of the citizens of the United States in order to reach some sort of a determination of what is considered to be the commonly defined consensus in terms of morality, and in terms of defining life, and in terms of defining just the basic principles of ethical conduct within our society. So in that sense, there really does end up being a responsibility, interestingly enough, on our part to define clearly what the tenets of our own faith are, because they really do have a relevance in terms of helping to instruct and inform those who live within the surrounding society. To whatever degree we have the ability to have this type of influence, it could very well be, according to many commentators, that we have a real responsibility, not only to act with integrity within our own secluded communities, but to actually be the Or Goyim, as the Pasuk in Yeshayahu says, to be a beacon of light unto the nations in terms of their being able to learn from our principle. And this is derived by some from the ruling in the Rambam, which is source number 9, where the Rambam says, the Rambam is referring to Jews who are governing the land of Israel, and the non-Jews who are live as citizens within that nation. That they should also be subject to a system of laws based on the seven Noahide laws. Kidei shelo yishafei sa'olam, so that the world not be destroyed, that we have a certain responsibility towards the broader universe to see to it that the world around us not be a corrupt universe. I mean, it's interesting, there are different approaches towards this. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was of the opinion that Jews have a real affirmative obligation to go out and to teach all of the Noahide laws to all of the nations around us and to make sure that they know what they're supposed to do according to Torah law. But even those who didn't go as far as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, there's an article by Rabbi Blight actually on this subject in his second volume of Contemporary Halachic Problems, will say, based on this Rambam and other pertinent sources, it's a Medrash, which is source number 8, you have an obligation to declare the divinity and the majesty of God to the nations of the world. They say that there is still an obligation to serve as a moral compass for the surrounding society. And this is not necessarily an evangelistic type of a proposition, but is very consistent with what is really required of us and requested of us by secular society as well. Even when secular society is making determinations with respect to how they're going to define the institution of marriage or things of that sort, and I know here I'm getting into even more sensitive territory, but I'm going to keep you late, I'll make it interesting, when it comes to this type of issue, I mean, we have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, as it says in source number 7, that source number 7 says that, you know, as corrupt as the world around us, you know, might get, there are at least three things that were always preserved in order to keep, you know, society decent. And one was that the nations of the world respected the Torah, they respected the Bible. Second is that the nations of the world did not sell human flesh in the marketplace. And the third is that they didn't write marriage contracts for same-sex couples. Whatever one's, you know, approach might be with respect to secular society, this doesn't necessarily mean that there's an obligation for Jews to, you know, storm the Supreme Court and take it over and say, okay, now we're in charge and, you know, we'll tell you what to do. But what it does mean is that to whatever degree you have cases like Roe v. Wade and you have the secular world turning, you have the courts and turning to the Torah authorities and saying, well, in terms of just framing what should be the evolving standards of morality for society, how are we going to define categories, constitutional categories going forward, the extent that they turn to us and say, we want to know what is the Jewish perspective, just so that can be taken into account, just so that can be properly incorporated in terms of fulfilling our mandate of being Or Goyim. So I think that our job when it comes to these matters is, number one, to fight for and preserve as much as possible the free exercise of religion, but number two, to make sure to educate and inform the world about what our principles are. What do we believe to be the essential, appropriate principles of morality, both for members of the Jewish religion and in terms of our perspective of the universe as a whole. And then, just once we have articulated those principles, of course, the way in which at least the society around us functions most successfully is if they have the ability to take that into account, at least in terms of framing what they believe to be the appropriate principles that encapsulate their definition of what are the moral standards of the society that they are responsible for representing. But at the very least, we have to be open, and we have to be accurate in terms of depicting what types of standards we stand for as a people. So just kind of in sum, what I guess I want to say is that there really are different systems of law. Torah has always recognized that there is a legitimacy to a system of law that is enacted by a secular government in which we might be living at any point in time. But Torah also enjoins us, and this is very much, I believe, a message of Hanukkah, to preserve our notion of Rosh Chodesh, to preserve our notion of being in charge of our own destiny, of being proud in our own heritage, of preserving the Torah, while at the same time respecting the legitimacy of a secular society, paying our taxes and paying our dues, but preserving the integrity of our religion in the ritual sphere, as well as the monetary sphere, and above all else, behaving in a morally and ethically impeccable fashion, so that we really will be or goyim, that we will be respected by all of those who surround us, and will be able to be a positive force for a society as a whole, now and forever after. If you'd like, I'm happy to take some questions. Yes. And please feel free to leave. I will not be insulted at all. We've reached the end of the time. I'll take some questions. Yes, go ahead.